Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today we have two very special guests from India, Sudarshan Suchi and Shweta Malhotra. Sudarshan is a CEO of Balraksha Bharat, which is Save the Children India. As a staunch believer in participatory processes, Sudarshan believes in co-creation and inclusion of all voices. Passionate about building self-reliance and creating lively opportunities, he has dabbled in promoting eco-friendly farming practices. Sudarshan graduated in philosophy, law, and completed a master's in participation power and social change. Yet he admits that most of his education happened from experience. And over the past three decades, he's had leadership positions with different organizations. As CEO of Save the Children in India, Sudarshan believes in creating a living organization. His vision is to build and grow the movement for child rights in India. You're welcome, Sudarshan. Let's introduce Shweta. Shweta has 17 years dedicated experience at Balraksha Bharat. She currently serves as head of governance and OD. In this role, she oversees the board, CEO's office, and she plays a pivotal role in enhancing the organization's adaptability in this fast-changing dynamic environment. Shweta is a true advocate for fostering a human-centric culture, and she thrives on meaningful connections with people. Great to have you on the show. How are you both?
Lovely.
Absolutely delighted. Yeah.
Okay, so let me give the audience some context. So many of you know that I'm working with the Humanitarian Leadership Academy and Save the Children internationally. We're doing a lot of work. Shweta's on an eco-leadership certificate we're running, and she said, "You must talk to Sudarshan. He's really interested in eco leadership, and he works in this way anyway." So I said, "Let's have a podcast and discuss this more." So here we are.
Here we are.
So let's start with you, Sudarshan. You're how long have you been CEO of Save in India?
For 3 years and a little over.
Yeah. And you're going through very fast changing times. Yeah.
We are going through like a constant, turbulent and changing times. And
And do you want to say something about how you're managing that? Just kind of open the conversation, say something about how you're managing those changes.
Yeah. So I take change as inevitable, essential and a constant. I mean, I look at everything as an institutional context is like furniture at home. Honestly, if it doesn't change on its own, I get restless and start moving it around. So this time, the change has come to me. It has not been caused by me. But I think change keeps you on the toes. It brings you back into a reality check and an opportunity for self-reflection, whatever. And I always start from hope and gratefulness. Mm-hmm. And these drive me more than all else, that there is a tomorrow and we are here and anything can be done.
But that's very inspiring. As Shweta knows, I use the term re-enchantment a lot, that there's many disenchanted people around in the world and in the humanitarian world as well. So we need people who can re-enchant our souls and our spirits to do the good work we have to do. Shweta, do you want to say something about the work you're doing?
So, Simon, I've said this on the course oftentimes that, you know, the course, the certificate course that I'm pursuing with you is almost like tailor-made for the situation the organization is right now. I mean, you know, whether it was an OD context we were going through or certain challenges which have come the organization's way. I mean, so many of the ideas and concepts, whether it's your ecosystem analysis, depth analysis, strategic analysis, you know, they're like, they're so relevant to what our organization's going through. So it's great. It's like, yeah. I've actually got a real life case to solve while still being on the course. So yeah.
That's good. We need a case study. So that's great. You got one. That's good. Yeah, I mean, the course was designed really, I mean, the way I frame this is that we live in a precarious, interdependent age. As you were saying, Sudarshan, fast change is just always going to happen, and it's getting faster and it's getting more precarious. So we have to get used to living in this space. We can't anymore think about, okay, one day we'll be more settled, one day it'll be more easier. It's not going to be. We're going to get technological change, environmental change, and we have to learn to live in this kind of fast-changing environment. And the course is really designed to kind of think about that. Eco-leadership is designed to think about, we live in a precarious age, and also this interdependence, you know, with the environmental challenges, as we know, we can't address this as one nation or one area. We have to think about our interdependencies, and the same with lots of our changes. We have to kind of think about the ecosystem we're living and working in, and how this is going to impact the work. And I know you've been doing that anyway, Shweta and Sudarshan. You've been kind of thinking about that. So tell us about some of your kind of key projects, what you're actually working on at the moment.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we were talking about this organization development journey, what we're traveling inside is about all about how we want to do our work outside. And both of these tied together with what I understand from eco-leadership. Mm-hmm. That is that you don't look at the world or life in parts and parcels and segments and silos. And it's not just interdependencies in the sense of a reluctance or of a forced interdependence, but it's an embracement and acknowledgement. So therefore, like within the organization, even the language we used, so our frontline people, the first responders, the most critical people working with children, were called the last mile workers.
Yeah.
And one of the first things we did is we said they are the first mile, because they are the first people getting. So that's the language part. Mm. And in terms of how do we engage with children, we said we would like to look at it holistically. That everything in the life of a child, a vulnerable child or their household, happens at the same time. It doesn't come planned. And therefore, if your responses are conditioned and are esteemed, you know, imagined from rows, columns and cells of Excel, life doesn't play it out that way.
No.
So therefore, we have encouraged that every person in our organization should be able to say, I am this organization. He or she wouldn't say, I am finance, you need to go to HR, or I am HR, you need to go to education or health, nothing. I am the organization. I am the face of it. I am the owner, and we will do whatever it takes. So this is the evolution we are going through, which actually acknowledges the external reality also of what we call as an ecosystem, and what I understand from Shweta and Archie about eco-leadership also, that it's about harmony, it's about integration, and I would say an ease and grace in doing things.
Mm-hmm.
So the underbelly is not transaction, but relationship.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
In what drives us as an identity.
Yeah, I mean, that aligns so closely to the work. I can see why Shweta said you must talk to Sudarshan. It's very, like we talk about participatory organizations, mutuality, like bringing kind of the people at the edge to the front of the conversations, ensuring that everybody has a voice, and really working hard to kind of believe that this idea of kind of the one organization and you're not kind of separate silos divided from each other is kind of essential. What are your thoughts, Shweta? What are you working on which would is kind of intriguing you at the moment?
For me, one of the most important themes right now is changed organization dynamics that we find ourselves is building the attracting and retaining talent. You know, building, how do we break down silos? How do we get, just as Sudarshan mentioned, a finance person, not just to think finance, but see how I can add value to how the money is being spent on the ground. An on-ground person being accountable to, you know, bring in, how do we deliver the program so fantastically that how can we garner more resources? So, you know, kind of how do we reform and reinvent the culture of the organization while retaining the values, the integral values of Save the Children, Bal Raksha Bharat, you know, where accountability, integrity, ambition, collaboration, while still retaining them, how do we kind of break down these silos and get people to think where one Bal Raksha Bharat gap, one organization gap? So,
yeah, really interesting. And India is a huge population. I think you're going to overtake China soon, or you're close to it.
Yeah.
Which means you have a lot of children and a lot of children with so many demands. How do you begin to prioritize your work? How do you manage that prioritization? Because the demand must be endless.
Yeah. So I think one of the things we're telling ourselves is we are not going to play God. And we are not a people who kind of take the burden of resolving everything everywhere. At the same time, we have made a conscious choice of being a part of the solution and not the problem. And the way we have chosen to be part of solution is to create capacities in the communities and in the children themselves. We believe that ultimate ownership of transformative change has to come from within a human being, within an ecosystem where they belong. And everything external would have an expiry date, so to say, and tends to be resource heavy. So the way we contribute is in two ways. One is we are trying, when I said about holistic, it's not about a prescriptive nature of solution or distributing material. It's about building capacities of people, building self-beliefs and being able to do. And on the other side, also work with the governments in the sense that eventually the biggest change maker, we believe, is the state. Actually, I shouldn't say government, I should say state. Yes. And various levels of state as an operation, because every citizen's relationship with state is very unique with the nation. And therefore, we believe ultimately it's the state system strengthening, which would deliver to the rights of a citizen. And on the other side, every citizen's capability to make informed, objective choices and participate in the democracy is the other side. So our roles are in enabling these two.
Yeah.
And yeah, very broadly.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting because when we do the ecosystem mapping ideas, we think about kind of who are the key actors, who can really drive change here, who do we need to speak to, can we influence those people? So that's precisely what you're doing. You're identifying kind of where real change can be made and not just delivering some aid for yourself, but really trying to influence those other people through collaboration, through partnerships, through engagement. That's just very, very interesting. Shweta, what are you thinking at the moment? What when you are hearing this conversation?
No, I'm just thinking that how, when you use this word partnership, if I look at myself with this organization, how partnership was defined, say 10, 12 years back, and how the definition of partnership has changed over a period of time, really shows that how this whole concept of eco-leadership or this distributed and situational leadership has evolved. At one point of time, partnership was, again, a very fixed idea as you exchanged something. And in the traditional sense for us as an organization, it was like a donor-donee relationship. You know, partnership, that collaboration word without a financial partnership didn't really exist so very widely in the context and in the language of the NGO, or specifically in the Bal Raksha Bharat context. But how that has changed now to partnership is not just a financial and a monetary transaction, a donor-donee, there's partnership of, you know, intellect, there's partnership of you bringing human resources. I mean, just a whole wide arena.
Yeah.
You know, and even our relationship with our donors, you know, corporate donors, it's no longer limited to only financial partnership or with government. It's a whole host of exchange of ideas. So it's great with the way we're progressing.
Yeah. I think two kind of shifts symbolically in words represent this. One is people have shifted, or we acknowledge that people are no longer beneficiaries, but they are primary stakeholders.
Yeah.
That's a big shift for us. The second was that the relationship of power is no longer power over or with, but it's about working about power within. And these actually define everything else about the way of doing things for us now.
Yeah, and this really aligns with the course Ashwasa knows, because we talk about mutualism and this idea that there's mutual agency, there's this mutual power, that recipients have power, not that we're going to empower people, but they actually have power. Let's listen to that power and let's kind of make space for that power rather than us giving power. It's a very different conceptualization, and creating shared value. I mean, it's not about giving aid. It's about kind of how can we co-create kind of development together. It's this mutual idea, isn't it? It's a very different way of thinking about the humanitarian aid from even 20 years ago.
Very, very true. Actually, it's about you know, it. So when we say about participatory processes or togetherness, you know, if today's larger language, even in development, has become that of corporate in terms of results, scales, perfection side, when you are investing in such processes, we are actually redefining success. Success is no longer just a number. People willing to try is success, not about success as achieving goal. You know, to be willing to climb Mount Everest is a success, and not necessarily reach the peak and put a flag there. You fall down, we celebrate that too. And Simon, just as a short shift from you know, from our conversation, I must mention that I had this lifelong desire of someday wanting to organizations to bring on board the things that didn't go right or well, be able to discuss those things and actually have that as a part of our, like an annual report that you acknowledge and celebrate. And last year, we actually could do it here. We had a four-day workshop on, it was called Failing Intelligently. It was a voluntary invitation to teams that come and share with us what didn't work.
Yeah.
And therefore, what did we get out of what didn't work? I tell you, we found a treasure.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
It was, yeah.
That's so important. I did some research on this very thing. There's the airline companies realized that unless they studied their failures, they were just going to repeat their failures. So they shifted their attention to kind of how can we learn from failures? How can we kind of really be creative around this? And it was interesting then, because the health sector really took this on board, because in the health sector, if you failed something, you covered it up. You didn't, you know, you were scared of being punished or scared of having insurance claims against you. So you hid failures, you know, but there's no learning in hiding failures. So that they got the airlines to come in and teach them how to kind of do the very thing you're suggesting. And it's a huge burden off your back as well. When you can actually discuss this openly, it kind of creates a real creativity, doesn't it? An openness. It's rather than a blame culture. It's a very different way of thinking.
Yeah. Very true. And I think some of these things begin from home. You know, I mean, it's not like there is, people call work-life balance, but I think values, beliefs, and ways of life or culture is something that's consistent across.
Yeah.
So, and therefore, I think what we've been trying, what Shweta was saying earlier in organization development, that we're trying to bring the values from being written somewhere to be practiced as a way of life, not to be named and called, but just bring it like as a natural reflex kind of context for people.
In your, I mean, India's got many cultures. I don't think you can talk about Indian culture because it's got so many cultures. It's very diverse. I've been a number of times, and it's so rich. Depending on where you go, it's very different. But there is traditions of hierarchy in India. There is traditions of controlling leadership. How do you find people are responding to your different, very different way of approaching leadership and approaching the work? What's the response like around you?
So I have to also remember that they'll be listening to this podcast at some time. No, but I think, you know, my learning is that people start with skepticism or with absolute disbelief. I think the defining parts are, how do you behave when something doesn't go right or when the things don't happen as per plan? I think people watch a leader. People watch a leader that, are you harsh at that time? Do you shift blames to others? Or do you pick up the threads and construct and, you know, say what to be done next quickly and gather? So I think we are going through those phases. And I also think, purely if one talks of this from a statistical or other context, then I would say that the more people are in an organization used to a certain way of working, the more the biological age is higher. Mm-hmm. Probably the capability of aligning or changing a way of doing things is tougher. For those who never seen, on the other side, for those who've just joined new or young, they wouldn't see any difference. They would say, well, this is how things probably would work always, everywhere. Every place is a Google or something like that. Yeah. So we have mixed blend. And then I think the challenges for us, the real challenge you mentioned about a certain part of our culture, you know, from a feudal context and others. So it is a challenge to be an inclusive organization, first by gender and then by beyond the binary into other contexts. It's something that's just slowly coming in.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So. And same, you know, I work all over the world, and I work in the private sector, in banking, in manufacturing, in health, in different sectors. And wherever you go, it's like eco-leadership 10, 15 years ago was seen as very marginalized, very utopian thinking. And now it's like, no, we need this because the world's changing so fast. We need to do things very differently. And these cultures also have controlling hierarchies, even when they pretend to be flatter, often there's still quite a lot of control there. So,
yes.
No, we find that challenge. And even in our humanitarian NGOs, we're finding it, you know, the change within the structures, they're still quite hierarchical and controlling. How can we really mobilize a different way of thinking? It's a challenge for us all, I think.
Yes, I think you has to be a... Go ahead,
No, no, come on, continue. No, I was just, you know, when you said that, you know, there was a lot of skepticism in the organization when we try out different things, or when, you know, situational leadership comes from unlikely places, as we've been trying to, and Sudarshan, like I've been telling you, Simon, has been trying to experiment. But, you know, some of the greatest success stories and the bright, brilliant ideas or ways of doing have come up when there's been when people have been forced initially skeptically, but then being forced into a certain situation to kind of bring out their situational leadership, and some of the brightest ideas have come along there. So, you know, I would really say our endeavor is to bring out more and more of this in, you know, throughout the organization and make this as a part of the culture for us.
Yeah. Actually, two things I wanted to flag. One is, you know, organization, I mean, and Simon, I'm reflecting more on when you were talking about international humanitarian organizations and others. When leadership as most often managers get mistaken as leaders, you know, people being in a position of power, I think managers are equal to results, and the results are normally quantitative, numerical. Yes. So normally organizations would tend to push people to get results. Mm. I personally feel that you should be willing to celebrate whatever is the result of people's endeavors. So the right way of doing things is far more important than, you know, the end outcome if you want to force it. So the willingness to trade off from the so-called end outcome result is what actually is in test for any organization constantly. And on the another different note, personally, around what Shweta was saying and our experience, it is a struggle for me personally. It's also a struggle because when people are used to the managers seen as leaders, so CEO is supposed to be the leader of all leaders, which means he's the wisest, he's the strongest, he's the only, and therefore he's the solution provider, he's the provider. So when people see me not taking decisions or abdicating or allowing somebody else in context, so they go through a lot of doubts, hesitations, and, you know, kind of worries that, you know, is this guy, I mean, is this the guy to bet on or not? And I, within me, I think that you should never bet on one person anyway, you know.
Okay.
And yeah, so even at home, I've had to play these games with my kids.
Yeah.
That sometimes I have to be necessarily incapable or look, you know, not willing to or not trying to do, so that they occupy that space.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if there's no, so this is also the other dimension of it.
Yeah, there's that dimension, and there's also, I mean, at the heart of what the work I do, I keep returning to this word generosity, because in my life I've worked in very controlling hierarchical spaces, and in other times there'll be an occasional leader who's been very generous and they trusted me and they said, "No, Simon, you can do it," and I'm really me, yeah, you go do it, and they open that space and they give you that opportunity and it's a no blame culture, so you can take the risk. And suddenly you grow and you fly and you realize you can do much more than you thought you could, you know, beyond your own expectations. And this generous culture, I think, is absolutely vital for this work.
Yes, and I feel many times people struggle in their identity or in their image of a leader. It doesn't match with leaders who are vulnerable, who are willing to be vulnerable. And
We did. We just come back from Poland, where we played an experiential learning event called the Leadership Game. And it's very interesting because we challenge these fundamental ideas around leadership being charismatic, loud, extrovert. You know, there's many different types of leader, and the quiet person sat in the corner, often they have the answers, the solution. Everyone's busy doing their fighting over how it should be. And then someone says, "Why don't you do this?" And, like, you know, you make the space and that little voice comes up. So, like, we really try and say that leadership can come in very different forms and very unique kind of ways, and always, and leadership and followership, they change as well. This is another thing we were discussing, how any good leader knows when to step back and become a follower and let someone else step up. It's not like a fixed position, is it?
Yeah, very, very true, actually. And I learned this in some ways in a hard way. And, you know, if I could narrate a story. So I used to work for this corporate Reliance Industries in India for its biofuels initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And we were a group of 40 people with about 6-8 of us identified as leader. And I was leading that team. And every year we would meet for our target setting annual work plan, we called it. And annual work plan means you, whatever you did last year or whatever you planned last year plus 2x or 4x. I mean, it was like an Excel-driven context. I don't know what happened that year. I just asked everybody the question that what do you think should be the target? And people, of course, the leaders, of course, lived up to my expectation. Each one put a bid saying we should be brave, we should. There was this one boy, he was the youngest among us and the junior most then. So this is about 2008-09, about 20 years now. He said, "If I was you, I would do 0 hectare and close this town." So then everybody pounced on him, you know, saying that. At first they pounced on me that, "Why do you give such spaces? And this is the result of it," you know, and they pounced on him. So I was also very upset and angry that, you know, why could, you know, he was like showing me the emperor's new clothes kind of situation. So I asked him, he said, look, we for last 3 years have been struggling and not a single hectare of plantation has lived up to its this thing. So if we don't have the courage to do it ourselves and establish it, it won't be appropriate to be scaling it up and out at some point. So it's much better at some point to embrace, reflect, stop, and do the course correction. And that actually was a life-defining moment for us. It was truth. It came from the youngest junior most. He was a trainee that time. He now heads a corporate foundation, but he was a trainee that time called young professional. And he showed us the mirror. It was a difficult, bitter pill to swallow. But once we swallowed it, it was with brilliant outcomes. I mean, we really evolved into a different role.
Yeah, that's a lovely story. It's what I call leadership from the edge. It's about hearing these voices, the quiet voices, the ones from the margins rather than the center. And often they can lead the biggest change. In the same way that we talk about social movements can lead change, often social movements like environmentalists, you know, they're seen as a bit crazy when they first start and they're strange people, you know, what are they saying? And now everyone's realizing actually they were speaking the truth. You know, they led the change and civil rights movements and women's rights movements the same. You know, often change does come from the edge. And that's a great example you just shared. Thinking about the ecosystem you work in. Sorry, Shraddha, go on.
I was just thinking that I think it takes courage to A, speak up from the edge or from the margins. And also it takes courage to embrace that voice. I mean, you know, and that's the kind of dynamics we're seeing now being coming up more and more in the humanitarian sector or in our development sector.
Yeah, and creating, I talk about rather than kind of developing leaders, creating spaces for leadership to emerge. So it's like creating a space so that voice can be heard. It's, you know, unless we actually create the space and hold open the space for these voices to be heard, you know, we probably won't hear them. They get squashed or put down. But we have to kind of create spaces. You create the space and someone will speak into that space. And it's like, I think that's one of the OD tasks we have to kind of work with. Yeah. How do we do that? How do we create the space so that people will step up and feel they can take a risk?
Yeah, that's right.
Thinking internationally about your position, you're in India. There's a lot. I did a report on the sector, and you know, reading lots of other people's reports, there's lots of talks of the colonization, the global north versus the global south. Now, how does it feel to be in India in this kind of more international environment of humanitarianism?
So I think. I look at being in India as a huge opportunity and as a huge promise, because the diversity and complexity of situations that exist in India is almost a representative of something of some magnitude in some part of the world.
Yeah.
So actually it gives an opportunity to get a hands-on engagement on the front line. I mean, I can sense the contradiction in what I'm saying. I would wish that those kind of situations didn't exist. Mm-hmm. I would wish, but the truth is that there is these situations, and therefore this diverse and complex situations of whatever can go wrong, going wrong, gives that experiential learning for people. So short while back mentioned about the first mile people. Mm-hmm. You know, when they were the last mile, we thought they were lowest in the pecking order of the food chain, and therefore maybe the lowest of capabilities. Now you realize that they are the movers of the earth. They are the doers. I mean, they are the foundation on which not just institutions, but movements are being built.
Yeah.
So when earthquake strikes, these are the people out there on day one. Mm. When COVID strikes, they are the ones who are on the street. When flood comes, they are there. When fire comes, whatever be the thing. So the limitless courage, presence of mind, ingenuity, they live in innovations. I mean, you know, they if there were PhDs to be awarded for their survival skills and innovation in survival skills, I would say each one of them would qualify probably for 10 PhDs. And I look at myself as one of the richest men in organization because of this kind of wealth, the wealth of people's capabilities and their resilience and the kind of solutions they come with impromptu there.
Yeah.
Despite us, despite, you know, the hierarchy and the structure.
Yeah, sure. Any thoughts, Retta?
No, I completely agree with, how Sudarshan's said, you know, this whole conversation about the last mile being the front mile and how the other people on the edge were bringing in. I mean, it resonates very well with the last module we did, one before that, the strategic analysis. You know, how when you develop a strategy, gone are those top-down days. I mean, it's basically we need to harness ideas and cultivate them from the edge, from people who are right there on the ground.
Yeah. And I think the European American models I've grown up with are part of the problem now, because we had this very 20th century culture of industrialization, of modernization, of thinking in very kind of linear ways and kind of hierarchical ways. That was kind of successful for the first part of last century, but it's led to this kind of environmental problems. It's led to a way of thinking. And people in our cultures find it very difficult to let go of these kind of ways of thinking, like modernity, growth, metrics. You know, these are hard baked into our systems. And I think in India, the context around ecosystems has been there for millennia. It's like that there's the idea of being precarious is very familiar. And I think there's. Now, we'll come to visit you in India, and it won't be to teach you, it's to learn from you, I think. I think you have so much to kind of teach us.
So if we look at the eco-leadership from the context of, let's say, farming or sustainable agriculture, so there are two schools. One is there's been a commercial agriculture, which is practiced by about 15% of the farmers in India. Who are the rich, the bigger, the higher producers.
Yeah.
And then there are 85% of small marginal farmers whose way of farming is sustainable and is organic.
Yeah.
But it's not certified. And they are the ones who actually on a larger basis who contribute to the resilience, you know, the water they conserve, the air they restore, the soil, the entire, so they hold everything together. And that's where this contradiction is, that, you know, they have to be broken first and then to be restored to be called sustainable, to first become unsustainable and then find, bring back their seeds, bring back their methods. Yeah.
No, that's a great example. We're coming to the end, and I asked my guests a question at the end about what it means to live a good life and create a good society. I wonder if either of you or both of you have any thoughts on these big questions. What it means to live a good life and create a good society.
So if I can go, I think creating a good life is all about not limiting your potential. Just kind of letting go, believing in yourself. In India, we have this word called shukrana, which is basically gratitude. So gratitude for everything. Don't limit yourself. As you know, Dr. Seuss, there's a saying by him, you have brains in your head and you have feet in your shoes. You can choose whichever direction you decide to choose. You can go in whichever direction you decide to choose.
Very nice. Very nice. See you, Sean.
Yeah, for me, actually, hope defines, and especially like for those of us who every day go to sleep knowing with a surety that tomorrow you've got food, you've got roof over your head. And therefore, if those kind of people are not a part of solution and net contributors. So I look at the purpose of life as actually this kind of a fulfillment? How do you, you know, contribute more and more to bring a more equitable society and a more democratic society?
Yes. Well, thank you both so much. That was a very, very insightful and rich conversation, and keep up the great work you're both doing.
Simon, thank you. Thanks, Simon.
What about you, Simon? We didn't hear your worldview.
Oh my God, you know, you're turning it on me. To live a good life, I think is very much about being grounded. There's something about I've experienced where we've become displaced, we've become dislocated from our bodies, from being grounded. And I think being close to nature, close to the ground, feet on the ground, somehow that gives us a sense of being part of the planet, being part of the earth, being part of other people, and it gives us a starting place to work from. So I think I'm learning that more and more. I'm learning, as Sreta knows from my courses, I talk about composting and harvesting and these metaphors, and they become important to me about being somehow understanding that we're part of this planet and we're not separate from it. I think it's really vital for these questions.
Yeah, I think I very much share that with you, both as metaphors and in terms of really doing it, the composting and the mulching and the thing. And also, you know, there's been this learning that you spend sometimes so much time to earn money that you forget to take time to spend it, you know, and spend it well. So then you. So thank you. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you very much. Really lovely talking to you.